back to the chair and held it steady as Rachel stepped up onto the armrests so she could get a downward view of the noose and the knot behind the dead man's head. "This doesn't work," she said. "You want me to look around for a ladder?" I asked. "No, I'm not talking about that. I think his neck is broken, and that doesn't really work."
"What do you mean doesn't work? I thought that's what happens when you hang yourself."
"No, not often with suicide by hanging." She put her ungloved hand on the top of my head to steady herself as she climbed off the arms of the chair. She stepped down off the chair, turned it on its side, and positioned it as it had been when we entered the garage. "You need a big drop to break the neck. Most hanging suicides basically die from strangulation. It was the execution hangings back in the day where you'd get a broken neck, because you'd drop through a trap door, fall 10 or 15 feet, and then the impact snaps the neck, causing instant death. You ever heard the phrase, 'build my gallows high'? I think it was a book or a movie or something. Whoever said that wanted to get it over with quick."
I raised my hand, pointing at the dead man. "Okay, then how did he get a broken neck?"
"Well, that's the thing. I think he was dead first, and then hung up like that to make it look like a suicide."
"So somebody broke his neck and then hoisted..." It hit me then. Somebody broke his neck, just like the four AOD victims. "Oh, man," I said. "What is going on here?"
"I don't know. But there has to be something in this lab that helps explain things. Look around. We have to hurry."
We searched, but found nothing. There was a desktop computer, but it was thumbprint protected. There were no hard files or lab books. Two whiteboards mounted on the walls had been erased. It became pretty clear that whoever had hung Hammond from the rafters, if the dead man was Hammond, had made sure that whatever the lab tech was doing with the female DNA he bought from Orange Nano was wiped clean as well. There was a refrigerator that had racks of test tubes, presumably holding DNA samples. I pulled one tube out of its slot and read the printing on the tape over the rubber seal at the top. "This stuff is from GT-23, I said. "Says it right here on the tube."
"Not a surprise," Rachel said.
"There's nothing else here," I said. "Just a dead guy and that's it."
"We still have the rest of the house to check," Rachel said.
"We don't have time. We have to get out of here. Whoever did this probably spent all night searching the place. Whatever was here is gone, and probably so is my story."
"It's not about your story anymore, Jack. This is bigger than your story. Check the printer."
She pointed behind me. I turned and went to the printer that was on a cabinet, pushed up against one of the garage doors. The tray was empty. "Nothing here," I said.
"We can print the last job," Rachel said.
She stepped over and looked at the printer. Still wearing a single glove, she pressed the menu button on the printer's control screen.
"Little known fact," she said. "Almost all modern printers print from memory. You send the job from your computer. It goes into printer buffer memory, and then it starts to print. It means the last job is in memory until a new job comes in."
She clicked on the Device Options tab and chose the Print Memory option. The machine immediately started humming and was soon printing pages. We both stood there watching. The last job was a big one. Many pages were sliding into the tray.
"The question is, who printed this?" Rachel said. "This guy? Or his killer?"
Finally, the printing stopped. There were at least 50 pages in the tray. I made no move to grab the stack.
"What's wrong?" Rachel asked. "Take the printouts."
"No, I need you to take them," I said.
"What are you talking about?"
"I'm a reporter. I can't just come into some dead guy's house and take printouts from his computer, but you can. You don't have to live by the same standards I do.
Either way, it's a criminal act, and that trumps your journalistic ethics."
"Maybe. But just the same, you can take the pages and then give them to me as my source.
Then I can use them, stolen or not, in a story.
You mean like we did before, and it cost me my job?
Look, can you just take the pages and we can talk about this later? I want to either call the police or get the hell out of here.
All right, but this buys me into the case.
She scooped the thick sheaf of documents out of the tray. It's not a case, I said. It's a story.
I told you, it's more than that now, she said, and I'm totally in.
Fine. Split or call it in.
Your car has been sitting out there at least a half hour. It was most likely seen by a neighbor, and if not, there are probably cameras on every house. Too risky. I say we secure the documents and call it in.
And we tell them everything?
We don't know everything. This is going to be Burbank PD, not LA, so they won't connect the dots to the other murders, not at first. I think you run your original cover story about researching DNA data protections and say you followed the bouncing ball to this guy and this lab, and here you are.
And what about you?
I'm your girlfriend, and I just came along for the ride.
Really? My girlfriend?
We can discuss that later, too. We need to find a place to hide the printouts. If they're good, they'll search your car.
You're kidding. I would, if it was my call.
Yeah, but you're better than everybody.
I have so many files and other junk in the back of my Jeep, they won't know what it is if they look.
Suit yourself.
She handed me the stack of documents.
Then, as your source, she said, I am officially giving these to you.
I took the stack. Thank you, source, I said.
But that means they're mine, and I want them back, she said.
Chapter 27. After camouflaging the printouts in the paperwork debris that monopolized the back seat of my Jeep, I dialed 911 on my cell and reported finding the body to the Burbank police. 10 minutes later, a patrol car arrived, followed by a rescue ambulance. I left Rachel in the Jeep and got out. After showing my driver's license and press pass to an officer named Kenyon, I assured him that the RA and its EMTs were not necessary.
They respond on all death calls, Kenyon said, just in case.
Did you go inside the house?
Yes, I told the dispatcher that, I said. The door was open and something seemed wrong. I called out, rang the doorbell, nobody answered. So I went in, looked around, continued to call out Hammond's name, and eventually found the body.
Who is Hammond?
Marshall Hammond. He lives here, or lived here. You have to ID the body, of course, but I'm pretty sure that's him.
What about the woman in the Jeep? Did she go in?
Yes. We're going to have to talk to her.
I know. She knows.
We'll let the detectives handle that.
What detectives?
They also roll on all death cases.
How long you think I'll have to wait?
They'll be here any minute. Let's run down your story. Why were you here?
I gave him the clean version. I was working on a story on the security of DNA samples submitted to genetic analysis companies, and it led me to want to talk to Marshall Hammond, because he ran a private lab and also had a foot in law enforcement. This was not a lie. It just wasn't a full explanation. Kenyon wrote down some notes while I spoke. I glanced back at the Jeep casually to see if Rachel could see me talking to him. Rachel had her eyes down, like she was reading something. An unmarked police car arrived on scene, and two men in suits emerged. The detectives. They spoke briefly to each other, and then one headed toward the front door of the house, while the other came to me. He was mid-40s, white, with a military bearing. He introduced himself as Detective Simpson, no first name. He told Kenyon that he would take it from here, and to file his paperwork on the call before EOW, which I was pretty sure meant end of watch. He waited for Kenyon to walk away before addressing me.
Jack McAvoy.
Why do I know that name? He asked.
Not sure, I said. I haven't done much in Burbank before. It'll come to me. Why don't we start with you telling me what brought you here today to discover this body inside the house?
I just told Officer Kenyon all that.
I know, and now you have to tell me.
I gave him the exact same story. But Simpson stopped the narrative often to ask detailed questions
about what I did and what I saw. I believed I handled it well, but there was a reason he was a detective and Kenyon was a patrol officer. Simpson knew what to ask, and soon I found myself lying to the police. Not a good thing for a reporter, or anybody for that matter.
"Did you take anything from the house?" he asked.
"No, why would I do that?" I said.
"You tell me. This story you say you're working on, were you looking at any sort of impropriety involving Marshall Hammond?"
"I don't think I have to reveal all the details of the story, but I want to cooperate, so I'll tell you the answer is no. I knew very little about Hammond, other than that he was a second-tier buyer of DNA samples and data, and that made him of interest to me." I gestured toward the house. "I mean, the guy ran a DNA lab out of his garage," I said. "That was pretty curious to me."
Simpson did what all good detectives do. He asked his questions in a non-linear fashion, so the conversation was disjointed and seemed to be all over the place. But in reality, he was trying to keep me from relaxing. He wanted to see if I might slip up or contradict myself in my answers.
"What about your side piece?" he asked.
"Side piece?" I said.
"The woman in your car, what's she doing here?"
"Well, she's a private detective who helps me with my work sometimes. She's also sort of my girlfriend."
"Sort of?"
"Well, you know, I'm not sure about things, but it doesn't have anything."
"What did you take from the house?"
"I told you, nothing. We found the body, and then I called the police. That's it."
"We found the body. So your girlfriend went in with you from the start?"
"Yes, I said that."
"No, you indicated you called her in after finding the body."
"If I did that, I was wrong. We went in together."
"Okay, why don't you stay right here and I'll go talk to her?"
"Fine, go ahead."
"Mind if I look around in your vehicle?"
"No, go ahead if you have to."
"So you are giving me permission to search your vehicle?"
"You said look around, that's fine. If searching means impounding it, then no, I need my car to get around."
"Why would we want to impound it?"
"I don't know, there's nothing in there. You're really making me regret calling you guys. You do the right thing and you get this."
"What is this?"
"The third degree. I didn't do anything wrong here. You haven't even been in the house and you're acting like I did something wrong.
Just stay here while I go talk to your sort of girlfriend."
"See, that's what I mean. Your tone is bullshit."
"Sir, when we are finished here, I'll explain how you can make a complaint to the department about my tone."
"I don't want to make a complaint. I just want to finish here so I can go back to work." He left me there, and I stood on the street watching him interview Rachel, who had stepped out of the Jeep. They were too far away for me to hear the exchange and confirm that she was telling him the same story I had. But my pulse kicked up a notch when I saw she was holding the stack of printouts from Hammond's lab in her hand while talking to Simpson. At one point, she even gestured toward the house with the stack, and I had to wonder if she was telling the detective where she had found the paperwork. But the conversation between Simpson and Rachel ended when the other detective came out the front door of the house and signaled for his partner over for a huddle. Simpson broke away from Rachel and spoke to his partner in hushed tones. I nonchalantly walked over to Rachel.
"What the hell, Rachel? You just going to give that stuff to them?"
"No, but I could tell you were going to give him permission to search the car. I have certain protections for my clients, so I was prepared to say it was work material I had with me and not part of any search they might conduct. Luckily, he never asked."
I was not convinced it was the best way to protect the cache of paperwork from the lab.
"We need to get out of here," I said.
"Well, we're going to find out right now if we can," she said.
I turned and saw Simpson walking toward us. I was ready for him to say that the case was now a murder investigation, that my vehicle would be impounded, and that Rachel and I would be taken to the station for further questioning. But he didn't.
"Okay, folks, we appreciate the cooperation," Simpson said. "We have your contact information, and we'll be in touch should we need anything else."
"So we can go?" I asked.
You can go, Simpson said.
What about the body?
Rachel asked. Is it suicide? It looks that way, yes, Simpson said. My partner confirmed it. We appreciate your calling it in.
All right then, I said.
I turned ahead to the Jeep. Rachel did as well. I remember who you are now, Simpson said. I turned back to him.
Excuse me? I asked.
I remember who you are now, he repeated. I read about the Scarecrow a few years back, or maybe it was one of those Dateline shows. Hell of a story.
Thanks, I said.
Rachel and I got into the Jeep and drove away. That guy didn't believe a word I said to him, I said.
Well, he may get a second shot at you, Rachel said.
What do you mean?
First, his partner is an idiot for signing off on that as suicide, but the coroner will probably set them straight and it may change to a murder case. They'll come back to us then.
That added a layer of dread to the moment. I looked down and saw that Rachel had the printouts on her lap. I remembered glancing back at her in the Jeep while I was being interviewed and seeing her eyes down. She had been reading.
Anything good in there? I asked.
I think so, Rachel said.
I think the picture is getting clear, but I need to keep reading. Let's go get that coffee you promised me.
Chapter 28. I sat in the conference room with Myron Levin and Emily Atwater. Through the window to the newsroom, I could see Rachel sitting at my pod and waiting to be called in. She had asked to use my computer, so I knew she was still digging, even as I was attempting to keep her involved in the story. I thought it best that I explain things to Myron and Emily before Rachel came into the meeting. If you've read my books or know anything about me, you know who Rachel is, I said. She has helped me on the biggest stories of my career. She put herself on the line and protected me when I was at the Velvet Coffin, and it cost her her job as an FBI agent.
I think it also got the coffin shut down, Myron said.
That's a bit of an oversimplification, but yeah, that happened then too, I said. She had nothing to do with that.
And you want to bring her in on the story, Emily said.
Our story. When you hear what she has, you will see we have no choice, I said. And remember, it was my story before it was our story.
Oh, wow. A day doesn't go by that you don't throw that in my face, does it? Emily responded.
Emily, Myron said, trying to keep the peace.
No, it's true, she said. I've made some major gains in this story, and he wants to take what I bring and go off on his own with it.
No, I don't, I insisted. It's still our story. Like I said, Rachel isn't going to write it. She's not part of the byline. She's a source, Emily. She has information about Marshall Hammond that we need to have.
Why can't we get it direct from Marshall Hammond ourselves? Emily asked.
I mean, I was under the impression that we actually were reporters. We can't because he's dead, I said. He got murdered this morning, and Rachel and I found the body.
Are you fucking kidding me? Rachel said.
What? Myron exclaimed. If we had gotten to his place a little earlier, we probably would have run into the killer ourselves, I said.
Way to bury the lead, Myron said. Why didn't you tell me this from the start?
Because I'm telling you now, so you will understand why Rachel is so important to this. Let us tell you what happened, and then she'll explain what she's found out and where we're at.
Go get her, Myron said. Bring her in.
I got up, left the room, and walked to my pod. Okay, Rachel, they're ready, I said. Let's just go in and tell them what we've got.
That's the plan.
She stood up and started gathering the papers she had spread out on the desk. She carried the paperwork under my open laptop, an indication she had something on the screen she planned to show us.
You found something? I asked.
I found a lot, she said. I just feel like I should be presenting this to the police or the bureau, not the editor of a website.
I told you, not yet, I said.
Once we publish, you can give it to whoever you want. I turned and looked at her as I opened the door to the conference room. Showtime,
I whispered.
Myron had moved to a chair next to Emily, on one side of the table. Rachel and I sat across from them.
This is Rachel Walling, I said. Rachel, this is Myron Levin and Emily Atwater. So let's start with what happened this morning.
I proceeded to tell them how I stumbled across the connection between William Orton and Marshall Hammond, and how he had gone to Hammond's home and found him hanging from the crossbeam in his garage lab.
"And it's a suicide?" Myron asked.
"Well, it was pretty clear the police think that," I said. "But Rachel thinks otherwise." "His neck was broken," Rachel said. "But I estimated that his drop was no more than a foot. He was not a large or heavy man. I don't think that kind of drop breaks the neck. And since that is the recurring circumstance in the cases you're looking at here, I would term the death suspicious at the very least."
"Did you share this with the police when they said it was suicide?" Myron asked.
"No," I said. "They weren't interested in what we thought."
I looked at Rachel. I wanted to move on from the details of the death. She got the message.
"His broken neck is not the only reason to be suspicious," she said.
"What else is there?" Myron asked.
"Documents recovered from the lab reveal..."
"Recovered? What exactly does that mean?"
"I believe the killer spent time in Hammond's lab either before or after he killed him. He hacked the desktop that contained records of much of the lab's work. He printed out the records, but the printer memory kept the last 53 pages he printed. I printed those pages, and that's what I've been studying. We now have a good amount of documentation from the lab."
"You stole it?"
"I took it. If that was stealing, then I would argue that I stole it from the killer. He was the one who printed it."
"Yeah, but you don't know for sure that's what happened. You can't do that."
I knew going into the meeting that this would be the place where ethical questions clashed with potentially the best and most important story of my career.
"Myron, you need to know what we've been able to learn from the printout," I said.
"No, I don't," Myron said. "I can't let my reporter steal documents, no matter how important they are to the story."
"Your reporter didn't steal them," I said. "I got them from a source."
"Her." I pointed to Rachel.
"That doesn't work," Myron said.
"It worked for the New York Times when they published the Pentagon Papers," I said. "They were stolen documents given to the Times by a source."
"That was the Pentagon Papers," Myron said. "We're talking about a totally different kind of story."
"Not if you ask me," I said. I knew it was a weak rejoinder. I gave it another shot.
"Look, we have a duty to report on this," I said. "The documents reveal that there is a killer out there using DNA to identify and acquire victims. Unsuspecting women who thought their DNA and identities were safe. This has never been seen before, and the public needs to know."
That created a moment of silence, until Emily bailed me out.
"I agree," she said.
"The transfer of documents is clean. She's a source, and we need to go public with what she knows, even if she came into possession of the documents in an unsavory way."
I looked at her and nodded, even though unsavory is not the word I would have used.
"I'm not agreeing to anything yet," Myron said. "But let's hear or see what you've got."
I turned and nodded to Rachel.
"I haven't even gotten through everything in the printouts," Rachel said, "but there is a lot there. First off, Hammond was a very angry man. In fact, he was an incel. Does everybody know what that is?"
"Involuntary celibate," Emily said. "Women haters. Real creeps."
Rachel nodded.
"He was part of a network, and that anger and that hate led him to create this," Rachel said.
She turned my laptop so it was facing Emily and Myron. She reached around the screen so she could manipulate the keyboard. On the screen was a red login page. Dirty 4. The page had fields for entering a username and password.
"Based on what I read in the pages, I was able to figure out Hammond's keywords," Rachel said. "His online name was The Hammer.
That was easy. And for the password, I started feeding keywords from an online incel glossary into the login. His password was Lubitz.
You bitch? Emily asked.
No, Lubitz, Rachel said. It's the name of a hero in the incel movement. A German airline pilot who intentionally crashed a plane he said was full of sluts and slayers.
Slayers? Myron said.
What incels call normal men who have normal sex lives. They hate them almost as much as they hate women. Anyway, there is a whole vocabulary within the incel movement, most of it misogynistic, and it's traded in online forums like Dirty Four.
Rachel typed in Hammond's username and password and entered the site.
We're in the dark web here, she said, and this is an invitation-only site that identifies women with a specific genetic pattern called DRD4 or Dirty Four.
What is it? Myron said. What does it determine?
It is a genetic sequence generally believed to be associated with addictive and risky behaviors, Rachel said, sex addiction being among them. Hammond was buying only female DNA from Orange Nano, Emily said. He must have been identifying women with DR4 in his lab. Women who had sent their DNA into GT23, never realizing it would be sold down the line to someone like him.
Exactly, Rachel said. But wasn't it anonymous? Myron asked.
It was supposed to be, Rachel said. But once samples were identified as having the DRD4 sequence, he had some means of reversing the anonymity. He was able to identify the women and put their identities, details, and locations on the Dirty Four website. Some of the profiles have cell numbers, home addresses, photos, everything. He sold them to his customers, who could search for women by location. If you are one of the creeps in Dallas, then you search for women in Dallas.
And then what? Myron asked. They go out and find these women? I don't...
Exactly, I said.
Christina Portrero complained to her friend that she met some creepy guy in a bar and he knew things about her he shouldn't have known. She thought she was being digitally stalked.
Dirty Four gave its members an edge, Rachel said. The women identified through DNA analysis by Hammond had the genetic makeup believed to be linked to promiscuity, as well as drug use, alcohol abuse, and other risky behaviors.
Easy marks, Emily said. He was telling his customers exactly who they were and where to find them. And one of those customers is a killer.
Exactly, Rachel said.
And we think that same customer is the one who killed Hammond, I added.
It appears from the printouts that Hammond had a partner in this, Rachel said. And they somehow became aware that women listed on the Dirty Four site were dying, were being killed. I think they looked at their subscriber base and figured out that there was at least one who had bought and downloaded the details of all the dead women. All of this is conjecture at the moment, but I think they warned him or told him to stop.
And that's what got Hammond killed? Myron asked.
Possibly, Rachel said.
Who is the customer? Myron asked.
The Shrike, Rachel said.
What?
Myron asked. It's the dark web, Rachel said. People use alternate names, IDs. If you are going to download names off a site like this, you don't give your real name and you don't pay with a credit card. You use an alias and you trade in cryptocurrency. The customer they identified as having downloaded the names of all four of the dead women went by the alias The Shrike.
Any idea what it means? Myron asked.
It's a bird, Emily said. My father was a birder. I remember him talking about shrikes.
Rachel nodded.
I looked it up, she said. It silently stalks and attacks from behind, gripping its victim's neck in its beak and viciously snapping it. It is considered one of nature's most formidable predators.
All the women had broken necks, Myron said. And this guy Hammond.
And there's something else, Rachel said. We think he may have hacked Hammond's computer or made him open it before he was murdered. He then started printing. We repeated the last job he sent to the printer. It was a file that had all the IDs of the women.
How many names? Myron asked.
I didn't count, Rachel said, but it looks like 100 or so.
Did you check to see if the 4 victims we know about are on the printout? I asked.
I did, but they're not on there, Rachel said. They could have been removed when it was determined they were dead.
So he kills Hammond and gets away with what? Myron asked. 100 names of potential victims?
That brought a long pause to the discussion.
Why would he print the names if he's already a customer and can access the same names through the site? Myron asked.
I think he's probably anticipating that the site is going to get closed down, Rachel said. He may know about Jack and Emily, or he might think law enforcement is closing in.
That puts a clock on things, Emily said. We can't sit on this and put those women at risk. We have to publish.
We don't even have the whole story yet, I said.
Doesn't matter, Rachel said. You people write your story while I take it to the bureau.
No, I said. I told you that had to, and I agreed, Rachel said. But that was before I saw what was in the printouts. I have to go to the bureau, and the bureau has to go to the police. This killer has all the names. They have to be protected. We can't wait.
She's right, Myron said.
It works, Jack, Emily said.
We can say the FBI is investigating. Give the story immediate credibility.
The FBI gets us past go.
I realized all 3 of them were right, and that I had just come off rather badly, putting the story ahead of the safety of dozens of women. I saw the disappointment in both Rachel's and Emily's eyes.
Okay, I said, but 2 things. We make it clear to the Bureau, the cops, any agency involved, that they can do what they need to do, but no press conferences or announcements until after we publish.
How long will that be? Rachel asked.
I looked at Myron and said the first number that popped into my head.
48 hours, I said.
Rachel thought about it and nodded.
I can try to make that work, she said. Realistically, it will probably take them that long to confirm what we give them.
Myron, you good with that? I asked.
Emily?
They both nodded their approval, and I looked at Rachel.
We're good, I said.
The Shrike. Chapter 29. He waited on the food court level at a table against the railing. It gave him a view directly down onto the second-level stores on the north side of the mall. There was a circular banquette designed as a spot for husbands to sit while waiting for their wives to shop. He did not know what Vogel looked like. Hammond's partner had managed to keep his images and locations off the web. Kudos for that. But the hacker was of a type. The man who called himself the Shrike hoped to be able to identify him among the weekday shoppers in the mall. The Shrike had picked the spot, putting out the mall location with the excuse that he, as Hammond, already planned to be there. It wasn't the best location for what he intended, but he didn't want to raise any suspicions in Vogel. The priority was to get him to come. He had a full tray of takeout food in front of him as camouflage. On the chair across the table from him was a shopping bag containing 2 gift-wrapped boxes that were empty. He was making a high-risk move, and blending in was key. He didn't touch any of the food, because after he ordered it, he thought it all smelled disgusting. He also thought it might draw attention to him if someone noticed he was wearing gloves, so he kept his hands down in his lap. He checked below and saw that a woman was now seated on the banquette. She was watching one of the children in the nearby kitty corner playground. No sign of anyone who might be Vogel. Can I clear anything here? He turned to see a table cleaner standing at his side. No, thank you, he said. I'm still working on it. He waited until the cleaner walked away before checking down below. Now the woman was gone, and a man had taken her place. He looked like he was in his early 30s. He had on jeans and a lightweight sweater. He seemed to be checking his surroundings in a casual but purposeful way. He wore sunglasses inside, and that was the final giveaway. It was Vogel. He was a bit early, but that was okay. It meant he might grow tired of waiting sooner and would leave when he believed the rendezvous was not happening. That was when the Shrike would follow him out.
Jack. Chapter 30. On any story reported by a team, there always comes the awkward decision of who writes it and who feeds the facts to the writer. Writing together never works. You can't sit side by side at the computer. The one who writes generally controls the tone of the story and the way the information is delivered, and usually gets the lead byline too. This was my story, and it was my call. But I was smart enough to know that Emily Atwater was the better writer, and I was the better digger. She had a way with words that I did not. I would be the first to admit that the two books I had published were heavily edited to the point of being reorganized and rewritten. All kudos to my editors, but the royalty check still went to me. Emily was a lean writer, a follower of the less is more school. Short sentences gave her stories momentum, and I was not blind to this. I also knew that putting her name first in the byline would not reflect badly on me. It would look like we had equal billing, because it would be in alphabetical order, Atwater and McAvoy. I told her she could write the story. She was at first floored and then thankful. I could tell she believed it was the right call. She was just surprised I had made it. I thought the moment helped me make up for some of my missteps with her lately. This decision to put her in the writer's chair freed me up to do more digging and to review what I had already reported. It also gave me time to notify people who had been helpful on the story and whom I had promised to alert. Christina Portrero's mother and Jamie Flynn's father were high on this list. I tried to make these notifications by phone, and the calls were more emotional than I had anticipated. Walter Flynn in Fort Worth burst into tears when I told him the FBI had now officially linked his daughter's death to a serial killer who was still at large. After the calls were out of the way, I started pulling together my notes and making a list of other people I needed to call for the first time or to check back with for any new information. We essentially had 24 hours, even though we had told Rachel Walling we needed twice that. It was a journalist trick to always say a story would take longer to report than it really did, or would be published later than it actually would. It gave us an edge against the investigations being leaked and our being scooped on our own story. I wasn't naive. Rachel was taking the story into the FBI's Los Angeles field office. There probably wasn't an agent in the building who didn't have an I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine deal with a reporter somewhere. I had been burned by the FBI on more than one occasion and still had the scars. Topping the list of who I needed to find and talk to was Hammond's unknown partner. There were emails scattered throughout the printouts from Hammond's house that indicated that he had a partner on Dirty Four who handled the digital aspects of the dark web venture while he handled the lab work. The partner's email identified him only as Rogue Vogue DRD4, and he used a Gmail account. The same alias was linked on the DRD4 site as the administrator. Rachel had said before leaving that she was confident the FBI could run it down, but I wasn't sure about that and didn't want to wait for the FBI. I contemplated directly reaching out to Rogue Vogue in a message, and after discussing it with Emily, I did just that. Hello, my name is Jack. I need to talk to you about Marshall Hammond. It wasn't suicide, and you could be in danger. We need to talk. I can help. I hit the send button and let it fly. It was a long shot, but a shot I had to take. Next, I started organizing what I would transfer to Emily for the story. She had not started writing, and I could hear her on the phone in her cubicle making calls to watchdog agencies and observers of the genetic analytics industry for general comments on what this sort of breach could mean. Every story had to have a lead quote, a line from a credible source that summed up the outrage or tragedy or irony of the story. It underscored the greater implications of the report. This story was going to trade in all of those elements, and we needed to come up with one quote that said it all, that no one was safe from this kind of intrusion and horror. It would give the story a deeper resonance than a basic murder story and would get it picked up by the networks and cable. Myron would be better able to place the story with one of the big media guns like the Washington Post or the New York Times. I heard Emily briefly summarize what we had found and what we would publish. As in her writing, she had a way of keeping it short and to the point. Still, I was getting nervous listening to her. My story paranoia was kicking in. We had to be careful when we solicited these comments because every one of those experts and industry observers could turn around and tip off a reporter they had a source relationship with. The trick was to give them enough information to respond with a usable quote without giving them enough to pass to another reporter. I tried to tune her out and go about my work, reviewing the early stages of my investigation before I knew what I had stumbled into. I thought about calling the LAPD detectives and asking if I had been cleared yet through DNA analysis and if they had made any headway on the case, but I concluded that would be a waste of time, as I was persona non grata with Mattson and Sakai. Next, I thought about causesofdeath.net and realized I had not checked the website since I saw the initial flurry of responses to my query. It had been a great starting point for me in connecting the cases linked, I believed, to the Shrike, and now I checked for more. I went to the message chain I had started with the inquiry about atlanto-occipital dislocation and saw that three messages had been posted since I last checked. The first was a follow-up by Dr. Adira Larkspur to her first post, in which the chief medical examiner had asked the original poster, me, to identify himself. This is a reminder that this forum is open to medical examiners and coroner's investigators only. The warning did not stop two others from posting. A day earlier, a medical examiner in Tucson, Arizona, reported that they had an AOD case with a female victim that was attributed to a motorcycle accident. The case was 6 months old, and no other details were offered. I copied the posting and shot it over to Emily in an email, alerting her that we might have a fifth case to look into. Her response came quickly. That can be a follow-up. Right now, we have to go with what we have confirmed and get the story out. I didn't respond. The latest message on the forum chain had drawn my full attention. It had been posted only 20 minutes earlier.
Wow, we just caught two of these in the same day, a hanging in Burbank and a fall in Northridge. Coincidence? I don't think so. GTO.
I was stunned by the message and read it several times before taking another breath. Obviously, the hanging in Burbank had to be Hammond, and I noted that GTO had not called it a suicide. I had no doubt that Rachel's take on Hammond's death had been on the money. Maybe the coroner's office was onto it as well. The second death was what had my full attention. A fatal fall in Northridge. Calling a death a fatal fall did not rule out the possibility of murder. I needed to get more details. Northridge was a valley neighborhood. I called the LAPD's Valley Bureau, identified myself as a journalist, and asked for the lieutenant. I wasn't connected for nearly 5 minutes, but refused to hang up, being better at waiting games than most of the people who didn't want to talk to me. Finally, I was connected. Lieutenant Harper, how can I help you? Lieutenant, this is Jack McAvoy. I work at a consumer watchdog website called Fair Warning, and how can I help you? Okay, well, I'm looking for information on the fatal fall up in Northridge today. Like I said, we are a consumer watchdog, and we pay attention to workplace injuries and accidents, etc. I was hoping you could tell me what happened. A guy fell off the roof of a parking structure. That's it. What parking structure? Where? He was in the mall up there, and when he left, he went to his car and then jumped or fell off the roof of the garage.
We're not sure which yet.
Did you identify the victim yet?
Yes, but we're not putting that out. We haven't found next of kin. You'll have to get the name from the coroner.
Okay, what about age?
He was 31, I think my guys told me.
The same age as Hammond, I noted.
There wasn't a note or anything?
Not that we've found.
I need to...
Just a couple last questions, Lieutenant. Were there any cameras that showed the fall and could shed light on what happened?
We do a camera canvas on these sorts of things, and we haven't found anything yet.
Who is the investigator assigned to this?
That would be Lefferts. He's lead.
Thank you, LT.
You got it.
A 5-minute wait for less than a minute of information. I next went to the website of the county medical examiner's office and pulled down the staff menu. I was trying to find out who GTO might be. None of the medical examiners fit the bill, but when I looked at the list of coroner's investigators, I zeroed in on Gonzalo Ortiz. My guess was that his middle name began with T. Sometimes a phone was the best way to get what you need, like when you were trying to penetrate the LAPD. But for the coroner's office, I wanted to go in person. I wanted a face-to-face with GTO, because I sensed from the message on the causes of death board that he might be a guy who would talk. Maybe it was a long shot, but I wanted to take it. I shut down my computer and walked over to Emily's pod. She was typing up notes from one of her calls. I think I found Hammond's partner. She immediately stopped typing and looked up at me.
Who is he?
I don't know. I didn't get a name yet.
Then where is he?
The coroner's office. He fell off a parking garage a couple hours ago, broke his neck. I'm going to go down there to see the investigator, see if he'll talk.
You mean broke his neck like we're seeing here?
She pointed to her screen, meaning the whole case. I nodded. There's a coroner's investigator who I think has put two and two together. He posted to me on the message board less than an hour ago. I want to go see if he'll talk. The LAPD won't tell me shit.
But doesn't he think you're a coroner after the way you first posted?
I don't know. The head medical examiner sort of outed me, but he still posted.
Well, don't dawdle. We have a lot to do.
Dawdle? Not my style. I'll call you after I get there. Chapter 31. It was my first time to the coroner's office in at least 4 years. It had been a regular stop for me when I covered crime for the Times and later the Coffin. But at fair warning, death had not been my beat until now. The death complex, as I termed it, was on Mission Road near the County USC Medical Center in Boyle Heights. The two medical centers, one for the dead, the other for the living, were attached by a long tunnel that once facilitated the movement of bodies from one side to the other. The original office sat close to the street, a forbidding brick structure that was nearly 100 years old and now was mostly used as a souvenir shop and for meeting rooms. They did big business selling toe tags, coroner's blankets, and other morbid items to the tourist trade. Behind the old structure was the new modern structure with clean lines and soothing beige tones. There was a glass-doored entrance that I used to get to the reception desk. I asked for Investigator Gonzalo Ortiz. The receptionist asked what my visit was in reference to.
The police told me to talk to the coroner's office to get information about a death, I said.
It happened today, up in the valley. It was a carefully crafted answer that did not contain a falsehood, but didn't exactly tell the whole truth. I hoped that the answer, plus my somber demeanor, would lead her to believe I was there as next of kin to someone awaiting autopsy. I didn't want her calling back to the investigations department and announcing that a reporter was in the lobby. If GTO refused to talk to me, I wanted him to tell me so to my face. The receptionist asked my name and then made a call. She spoke briefly to someone and then looked up at me.
"What's the name of the deceased?" she asked.
Now I was cornered, but I had an out. Burbank was considered part of the valley, so I could still answer without lying.
Marshall Hammond. The receptionist repeated the name and then listened. She hung up without another word.
He's in a meeting and will be out as soon as it ends, she said. There is a family room down that hall to the right.
She pointed behind me.
Okay, thanks.
I walked down the hall, hoping there would be no one in the family room, but had no such luck. This was Los Angeles, where more than 10 million people lived and died. Some unexpectedly, some by accident, and some by murder. I knew that the county coroner's office had a whole fleet of pale blue vans with racks in the back for making multiple body pickups. There was not a chance the family room would ever be empty. In fact, the place was almost full with small groups of grieving people huddled in silence or in tears, probably hoping there had been a mistake and it wasn't their loved one they had been asked to come identify or arrange for transfer and burial. I didn't mind skirting the truth with the receptionist, but here I felt like an intruder, an imposter they assumed was among them in loss and grief. I had been in their place once, with my brother, and I had knocked on the doors of homes where loved ones had been taken by violence. But something about this room was sacred. I felt awful, and thought about making a U-turn and just waiting for Gonzalo Ortiz in the hallway outside the door. But instead, I took the first seat near the door. The last thing I wanted was to interact with someone in the throes of their own pain, hoping to assuage mine with a smile of understanding. That would be like stealing. The wait felt like an hour, as I listened to murmured pleas and one woman began to wail. But the truth was that no more than 5 minutes after my arrival, I was rescued from the family room when a Latino man in his 50s, dark-skinned with a salt-and-pepper mustache, stepped in and asked if I was Mr. McAvoy. I was up and out of my seat faster than I could say yes. I led him out into the hallway and then hesitated when I realized he had to lead. "Let's take a shortcut," he said. He waved me down the hall in the opposite direction from reception. I followed. "Are you Investigator Ortiz?" I asked. "Yes, I am," he said, "and I have a private meeting room set up." I decided to wait till we got to the private room before explaining who I was and what I wanted. Ortiz used a card key to swipe the lock on a door marked "Authorized Personnel Only," and we were admitted to the pathology wing of the complex. I knew this because of the odor that engulfed me as we entered. It was the smell of death, cut with industrial-strength disinfectant, a sweet and decidedly sour smell that I knew would stay in my nasal passages long after I left the premises. It prompted me to remember the last time I had been in this place. It was 4 years earlier, when the chief medical examiner had gone public with complaints about health and safety issues in the complex, coupled with budgetary issues that affected staffing and crippled service. He reported autopsies being backed up by 50 bodies at a time, and toxicology testing taking months instead of weeks. It was a move to persuade the county commissioners to give him the budget he had requested, but it only resulted in the chief's being forced out of his job. I doubted much had changed since then, and was thinking of bringing up the issue with Ortiz as a way of breaking the ice, when I informed him I was a journalist. I could mention the stories I wrote about the deficiencies for the Velvet Coffin, in hopes that it would help convince him to talk to me about the atlanto-occipital dislocation cases. But as it turned out, I wasn't going to have to tell him I was a journalist or worry about breaking the ice. It had already been broken. Ortiz led me to a door marked Meeting Room B. He knocked once and opened the door, holding his arm out to usher me in first. As I entered, I saw a rectangular table with 6 chairs in the middle of the room. Sitting at the far end of the table were Detectives Mattson and Sakai. I probably revealed my surprise with a slight hesitation in my step, but then I regained speed and entered the room. I did my best to recover with a half smile. "Well, well, LAPD's finest," I said.
"Have a seat, Jack," Mattson said. He hadn't bothered intentionally mispronouncing my last name. I took that as a sign that maybe he had learned something from the stunt he had pulled arresting me. My surprise slipped into bafflement. Were they following me? How did they know I was going to the coroner's office? I took a chair directly across from Mattson, and Ortiz took the seat beside me. I put my backpack on the floor next to me. There was a momentary pause as we all stared at one another. I decided to start out incendiary and see what it got me. "You guys here to arrest me again?" I asked. "Not at all," Mattson said. "Let's put that behind us. Let's try to help each other here." "Really?" I said. "That's different. Are you the one who made the post on causes of death?" Ortiz said. I nodded. "Yeah, that was me," I said. "And I guess you're GTO." "That's right," Ortiz said. "Jack, I admit it. You put this thing together," Mattson said. "That's why I think we can help each. Last time we spoke, I was a murder suspect," I said. "Now you want to work together." "Jack, you're cleared," Mattson said. "The DNA was clean." "Thanks for letting me know," I said. "You did know," Mattson said. "You knew all along. I didn't think you were waiting for me. How about this? Did you tell Christina Potrero's friend that I wasn't the creep you told her I was?" I said. "It's at the top of my list," Mattson said. I shook my head. "Look, Mr. McAvoy," Sakai said, pronouncing my name perfectly, "we can sit here and potshot each other about mistakes made in the past, or we can work together. You get your story, and we get the guy out there who is killing people." I looked at Sakai. He was obviously assigned the role of peacemaker, the man who is above all the skirmishes with only the truth in his sights. "Whatever," I said. "You're about to get big-footed by the FBI. You'll be turning this over by tomorrow morning." Mattson looked stunned. "Jesus Christ, you went to the Bureau with this?" he exclaimed. "Why wouldn't I?" I asked. "I went to you people and you put me in jail." "Look, can I just say something?" Ortiz said, holding his hands up in a calming gesture. "We really need—" "No," Mattson said. "Who did you go to over there?" "I don't know," I said. "Another person I'm working on this with went there while I went here." "Call them off," Mattson said. "It's not their case." "It's not your case either," I said. "There are killings from here to Florida and up the coast to Santa Barbara. See? I told you he was the one who connected all of this," Ortiz said, looking at Mattson. "So why am I here?" I asked. "You want to know what I know? Then it's got to be an even trade, and it's got to be ironclad exclusive, or I am out of here. I'll take my chances with the FBI. Nobody said anything. After a few seconds, I started to get up. "Okay, then," I said. "Just hold your horses," Mattson said. "Sit down and let's cool down. Let's not forget that there's a sick fuck out there killing people." "Yeah, let's not," I said. Mattson turned slightly to check with his partner. Some sort of non-verbal message was communicated. Then he looked back at me. "All right, we trade," he said. "Info for info, intel for intel." "Fine," I said. "You first." Mattson spread his hands. "What do you want to know?" he said. "How'd you get here?" I asked. "Were you following me?" "I invited them," Ortiz said. "I saw the post." "Coincidence, Jack," Mattson said. "We were here, meeting with Gonzo, when you showed up." "Tell me why," I said. "Simple," Mattson said. "Gonzo started looking around after your post and started connecting cases, same as you. He knew Sakai and me had Potrero, so when two of these AOD cases came up in one day, he called us and said they might all be connected. Here we are." I realized that I was light years ahead of them on the investigation.
I could share some of what I knew and blow their minds and still keep some details for myself and my story. I also had the printouts from Hammond's lab that I had to be careful about revealing.
Your turn, Mattson said.
Not yet, I said. You haven't told me anything I don't already know.
Then what do you want? Mattson said.
The guy who fell off the parking garage today, who is he? I asked.
Gonzo? Mattson prompted.
Guy's name is Sanford Tolan, Ortiz said. 31 years old, lived in North Hollywood and worked at a liquor store.
That was not what I was expecting.
A liquor store? I asked.
Where?
Up in Sunland off Sherman Way, Ortiz said.
How does that fit with Hammond? I asked.
As far as we can tell, it doesn't, Mattson said.
So you're saying it's a coincidence? I asked. The two deaths are unrelated?
No, we're not saying that, Mattson countered.
Not yet. We're just getting into this thing.
He looked at Ortiz as if throwing the ball to him.
Autopsy has not been scheduled yet, Ortiz said. But the preliminary notes from the field indicate he was already dead when he fell.
How can they tell that? I asked.
We have witnesses, Ortiz said. He didn't yell, and he didn't attempt to break his fall, which we would have seen in the injuries. Plus, you don't see AOD in falls like this. A broken neck is common, but not AOD. There's no twisting of the neck in a fall like that.
You said he worked in a liquor store, I said. You mean, like, behind the counter?
Correct, Ortiz said.
What else do you know?
I pressed.
We know he had a criminal record, Ortiz said.
Ortiz looked at Mattson as if for permission. The whole deal's off if you hold back on me, I said.
Mattson nodded.
He was a pedophile, Ortiz said. Did 4 years in Corcoran for raping his stepson.
Again, the information didn't fit. I was expecting an internet cipher, some sort of expert who handled the dark web part of Dirty Four. A woman-hating incel, pedophile, was not part of the profile that was emerging.
Okay, Mattson said. Now it's your turn to give. Tell us something we don't know, Jack.
I nodded, and to buy some time, I reached down to my backpack, unzipped it, and pulled out the notebook in which I had written the facts of the story. I flipped through the pages for show, and then looked up at Mattson.
The man you're looking for calls himself the Shrike, I said.
Chapter 32. I sat in my Jeep in the parking lot of the coroner's office and made calls. I didn't want to be driving during these conversations. I also wanted a watch for Mattson and Sakai. They had stayed behind with Ortiz after our meeting, and I was curious to see how long it would be before they left. I didn't know what I would get from that, but I wanted to know anyway. The first call was to Emily Atwater to check on her status.
I've started writing, she reported. So far, so good. We've got a lot, so I'm playing with the balance. What to move up, what to move down. As you know, Myron doesn't like sidebars. So it's got to be one story and follow-ups in the days after. What about you?
I was wrong about the second case being Hammond's partner, I said. They think the Shrike might have made a mistake and killed the wrong guy, so we have to keep looking for him.
They?
Yeah, the police were here, Mattson and Sakai. With the help of a smart coroner's investigator, they've put the cases together.
Shit.
Well, I made a deal with them, traded information on the basis of exclusivity.
Can we trust them?
Not at all. I don't trust them, and I don't trust the FBI not to leak. So I held back. I gave them Dirty Four, but didn't mention GT-23 or Orange Nano or Hammond's connection to the Orton case. I think they have a lot of catching up to do before we have to worry about their leaking.
I saw a man and a woman leaving the coroner's office, arms wrapped around each other, heads down. I recognized them from the family room earlier. The man had tears on his face. The woman didn't. She was supporting him more than he was supporting her.
She walked him to the passenger side of a car and helped him get in before going around to get in behind the wheel. I saw a man in another car watching them as well.
Jack, you there?
Yeah.
Why do they think the shrike killed the wrong guy?
Because he was the wrong profile. Guy worked in a liquor store and was a convicted pedophile. Not the right fit.
We're just guessing here, but they think the shrike tried to lure Rogue Vogue to a meeting at the Northridge Mall and somehow thought this guy, his name was Sanford Tolan, was Rogue Vogue.
Tolan was there by himself, probably sitting around watching children in the mall. The shrike followed him out to his car, broke his neck, and threw him over the edge.
That's horrible. Do you think the shrike knows he made a mistake?
You mean like he realized this is not the right guy, but killed him anyway?
Maybe. Hard to say.
The whole idea of setting up the meeting is a guess.
What about the FBI? Have you heard from Rachel?
My next call. I wanted to check in with you first.
All right. Then I'm going to get back to it. Let me know what you know.
You got it.
Before calling Rachel, I pulled up my email account to check for new messages. My pulse jumped when I saw I had received a reply from Rogue Vogue to the message I had sent earlier.
I don't understand this. Who are you? Why did you send this to me?
I checked the time on the message and saw that it was sent well after the lifeless body of Sanford Tolan had dropped from the fourth floor of the mall parking garage. It was further proof that the shrike had killed the wrong man. The message was short and simple, and most of all, innocent. No acknowledgement, no admission. Just tell me more.
I considered how to answer in a way that would not scare him off. I can safeguard you. I can tell your story. I can be your go-between. I decided on a direct approach that laid the reality of his situation on the line. Looking up every few seconds or so to check for the detectives, I composed an email that I hoped would lead Rogue Vogue to trust me with his story and safety. I am a writer. I have written books about killers like The Poet and The Scarecrow. I am writing now about the shrike. You are in danger. He killed Hammond, and he killed a man he thought was you. I can help you. I can get you to safety, and I can tell your story. I know you and Hammond had nothing to do with the shrike. You never planned on that. I'm including my number here. Call me, and we can help each other. I read it twice and typed my cell number at the bottom before sending it. My hope was that Rogue Vogue would read and react to it right away. I checked the parking lot and the front of the coroner's office once more, but saw no sign of the LAPD detectives. I realized that they might have parked over at USC Medical Center and taken the tunnel through to the coroner's office. I may have missed them, but I decided to call Rachel while maintaining my vigil. She answered in a whisper.
Jack, are you okay?
I'm fine. I was just checking in. Did you meet with anybody yet?
Yes, we're in the middle of it. I just stepped out to take the call.
And?
Well, they're working on it. They're looking for other cases and trying to run down Hammond's partner. I should have something on that soon.
There might be a case in Tucson, but more importantly at the moment, there was another killing today here in LA. I thought it was Hammond's partner, but it's not. It looks like it's a mistake. Like the shrike thought it was Hammond's partner.